So that song we sang a second ago really reflects what we've been talking about here. We're in this series called Sons and Daughters of God. And we've been talking about this incredible idea from the Bible, and it's actually out on the wall out there in the foyer. It's this verse from the Bible where God actually says to those who come to him, he says, "I will be a father to you, and you will be my sons and daughters." Now think about that for a second. God actually wants us to call him Father. He even says we can call him Dad. That's like the most fundamental thing about our identity. What's core to who we are is that we're sons and daughters of God. And that means you can wake up tomorrow morning and you can look in the mirror, and there's a lot of things you can say about yourself. Like you could say engineer, you know, accountant, manager, salesperson, teacher, or maybe even unemployed, you know. You could say single, married, young adult, you know, blue collar, middle class, whatever. You could say all these things. You could say bored, busy, discontent, maybe depressed, adventurous. You could use all kinds of adjectives or labels to describe who you are. But the most fundamental label, the most core label, the thing that's most central to your identity is simply son of God. Daughter of God, child of God. That's everything else flows out of that. That's sort of at the middle. Everything else is true about you, but everything else is wrapped up in that identity that you're a child of God. Now, we've looked at several aspects of what this means over the last several weeks. We've talked about how God adopts us as his children, kind of like that video earlier. God adopts us as his children. God feeds us and takes care of us. God restores us. And then even last week, we looked at this idea that sometimes God even disciplines us. But that's what good parents do. Sometimes good parents need to discipline their children. And God even does that to us. Why? Because we're his sons and daughters. And because he loves us. Now, we're going to look at one more thing today. One more thing that's true about this relationship, about being a son or daughter of God. And I want to actually teach you a Hebrew word today. So we're going to get a little old school. It's going to actually feel like you're going to school. Because I want to teach you something about Hebrew. I want to teach you about this word that's found all throughout the Old Testament. And it's wrapped up in this idea of what it means to be a son or daughter of God. And it's got a bunch of different meanings, and there's a bunch of different things going on around it. And I think there's a powerful truth wrapped up in this word. So I want to just kind of go academic for a second. More than a second. For a few minutes this morning. Now, if you're new to the Bible, or even if you've read the Bible a lot, here's kind of a refresher. The Bible is made up of an Old Testament and New Testament, right? There's two parts, and we'll put up on the screen sort of a little graphic. There's two parts of the Bible. There's the Old Testament and New Testament, right? And the Old Testament's somewhat longer than the New Testament. There's 39 books in the Old Testament. So the Old Testament, we often think of the Bible or even the Old Testament as one book, but remember, it's a bunch of different writings written by a bunch of different people. They're just all collected together. So the Old Testament has 39 different books. The New Testament has 27 different books. Old Testament is primarily about this nation of Israel. From the time period of about 1200 BC to 400 BC. There's a few other things in there, but that's the main sort of thrust. It's the history and the stories and the songs and the prayers and the messages of the nation of Israel between those time periods. And then the New Testament is mostly about Jesus, who was a Jewish teacher from the people of Israel a few hundred years later. It's about Jesus and the movement he started called the early church. And it takes place or covers a time period from about 4 BC, that's when we think Jesus was probably born, to about AD 100. Now, the Old Testament was written in Hebrew because the people of Israel at that time, that was their language. That's what they spoke. That's what they wrote in. So all of those writings, there's a few in Aramaic, but almost all of those writings are in the language of Hebrew. But then about 300 BC, Alexander the Great conquered like the known world at the time. Remember, he was Greek. And so he spread Greek culture and Greek language everywhere. And so by the time of Jesus, most people spoke and wrote in Greek. And that's why it was the common trade language of the day. And that's why the New Testament writings are written in Greek. So when you read a Bible, when you have your own Bible and you read it, kind of the version you read today, what you're actually reading is an English translation of the original Hebrew or the original Greek. And what you need to know is that these translations, because they're translations, that's actually why we have a lot of different versions. You may have always wondered that. Why are there so many different English versions? Well, it's because they're different translations from Hebrew and Greek. And everyone who's ever translated from one language to another knows it's not really a science. It's more of an art. You can translate things in different ways. And so there's different theories on translations. But all of the translations we have today are really good. The one we use here is called the NIV because we think it's one of the best. But what you need to know is that when you read your English Bible, like you can get a really good sense of what the original intent and meaning of these writings are, even though they're originally written in Hebrew and Greek. In fact, think about this for a second. A lot of the people who lived in the New Testament time period didn't even know Hebrew. So they, the people that we consider like pillars of the faith, many of them didn't even know the language that the Old Testament was written in. Many of them just knew Greek. So they were actually reading, when they read the Old Testament, they didn't call it that then, they called it the Hebrew Bible. When they read it then, they were actually reading a Greek translation of the Old Testament. So they didn't even know the original language that it was written in. And yet, we see that they were able to understand and know God and read what was written in there and have a sense of what God was trying to tell them for their lives. So you need to know when you read your English Bible, there's a lot of confidence there that you can understand what God wants to tell you and communicate through it. And yet, I see it as one of my roles as a pastor and sort of as a teacher to actually learn a little bit of Hebrew and Greek. And to recognize that from time to time, there are some nuances in the original language. And there are some additional layers of meaning that you can find and you can see there. And so one of our responsibilities as pastors is to try to bring those out to you when we stumble across them in the Bible. And so I want to do that today by sharing with you one Hebrew word that you're going to say you know and you've learned after you leave today. And here's the Hebrew word. We're going to put it on the screen now. Can anyone read that? The little funky letters up there? Yeah? It's what? No. It's the word nasa. So it's the word nasa. Let's all say it together. Nasa. One more time. Nasa. Okay, so let me tell you about this. Obviously, Hebrew has a very different alphabet than English. And so there's actually three letters up there, the top part in the white. There's three letters up there. And it's interesting because Hebrew words, the way they work is that's a verb, the verb nasa. It means to do something. I'll tell you what it means in a second. But Hebrew is built around three letters. And every major Hebrew word has a root of three letters. And it's a verb that means to do something. And then you can add different letters and you can do different things to it. And that'll turn it into a noun or that'll turn it into an adjective or that'll change the tense of the verb. All kinds of different things. But they all have three letters and they're actually consonants. They're not vowels. That's a whole other story. But vowels are these little tick marks that are added later. But those are three Hebrew consonants. Now, another thing that's interesting about Hebrew is it reads from right to left. It reads the exact opposite of the way we read in English. So actually, the letter on the right is a nun, and it has an N sound, na. The letter in the middle is a sin, and it has an S sound, sa. And the letter on the left is an aleph sound, or the aleph letter. That's the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And it actually is silent. It doesn't have any sound at all, and so we just put an apostrophe there. So to understand this, you add the vowel sounds, the A sound between the two, and you get nasa, nasa. So that's the word nasa. Now, let me tell you a few things about this word, because it's a really important word. The word nasa is used 655 times in the Old Testament as a verb. So it's actually used in a bunch of different ways. It's turned into a noun or it's turned into an adjective or some other things, but it's used 655 times in the Old Testament as a verb. And that's important because anytime one word is used throughout a bunch of different writings, remember they're all written by different people, a whole bunch of different ways, and it's very consistently used, that means it must be a really important word. There must be something important that we need to know about this word, nasa. So it's used 655 times. Let's go to the next slide. And, let's go backwards. Oh, no. Yeah, let's go to that slide. This is the word nasa in Hebrew. This is a verse from the Bible. This is Deuteronomy 1:31. We're going to read this in English in a second. But you can actually see sort of in the different color, there's the word nasa. So you see it in the top. in Sin Aleph, Nun, so Nasa, and then down the bottom, actually the Nun is dropped because in different tenses of the verb, the Nun is dropped and a Yod, that's where that little tick mark thing is added. And so it changes the meaning or the tense of the verb a little bit. And all those little marks are all the vowels that go with it as well. So that's Hebrew. It looks fun to read, right? So let's go forward. Like, as I said, 655 times it's used in the Old Testament. It's also used a bunch of different ways. And words have a large range of meaning. So one word can actually mean a bunch of different things. Now, we have this in English, right? So let me tell you about the English word key. What does the word key mean in English? Well, it's the thing that you use to unlock your door, right? It's also the thing that you use to type on your laptop, on your keyboard. If you're in the band, it's a bunch of notes on a musical scale. That's what key means as well. If you're from Florida, it's an island off of the coast. If you're a basketball fan, it's a certain spot on the floor that you shoot from, the top of the key, right? If you like limes, there's a certain kind of lime that you would like. It's key lime. And if you like food, there's a certain kind of food, key lime pie, right? It can also be an adjective. The key ingredient of key lime pie is key limes, right? So we could go on and on, but the word key has all kinds of different meanings in English. But guess what? In Spanish, there's like eight different words that mean those eight different things. There's not one word in Spanish that mean all those same things. And so if you're translating a sentence that has the word key in English into Spanish, you have to be able to see the whole sentence. You have to know it in context, and you have to know which meaning is being used so you can find the right word in Spanish to translate the word key in English, because the word key has a huge range of meaning. It's the same in Hebrew. It's the same in all languages. So the word nasa has a big range of meaning. In fact, in your English Bibles, it's actually translated about 20 to 25 different ways. There's a bunch of different English words that's used to translate this word nasa. But you can really group them into three primary ways, and that's what I want to do. I want to spend the rest of our time just unpacking these three primary ways this one word is used and show you how important it is for understanding our relationship with God as sons and daughters of God and Him as our Father. So the first word, or the first use of the word nasa, is to lift, to lift. Now, in seminary, I had little things to remember definitions of words, because you have to memorize all these words from the Old Testament. And so I had little ways to remember. So what does the word nasa look like in English? NASA, right? So every time I saw it, I just thought, like, lift off, like rockets lift off. So nasa means to lift. That was my way of remembering what this word means. And that's the first primary way that this word is translated in English. It means to lift or to lift up or to lift off. So it's used all the time in the Old Testament to talk about people lifting their hands, people lifting their heads, someone lifting their eyes and looking up in the sky, people lifting their voices. That's not literal, that's more figurative. We use lift the same way in English. When someone lifts their voices up, lifting up a prayer, lifting up a song, even lifting up people's hearts. So this word nasa means to lift or to lift up. Now, the very first time this word is used in the Bible is in Genesis chapter 4, in this story between these two brothers named Cain and Abel. You remember this story, or if you don't remember it, these two brothers brought these offerings to God, and God accepted Abel's offering, but he did not accept Cain's offering. We don't know for certain why, but it seems like from the story that Cain didn't bring his best to God. It's like he was holding back or his heart wasn't in the right place. And so he sort of brought just an average offering, and God said, I'm not going to accept it. And Cain got mad. It says he gets mad and he gets, you know, depressed, and it says he actually gets downcast. His face looks down. And God comes to Cain and God says this. This is from Genesis 4, verse 6. Then Yahweh, that was the name that Hebrews used for God. Then Yahweh said to Cain, why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be nasad? I just kind of added the ED. That's the English part. It didn't actually say that in Hebrew. but I didn't want to translate it for you. I just want to put it in there. If you'll do what's right, will you not be lifted up? I'm not mad at you, Cain. I just didn't think your offering was really that good. And so your heart wasn't in the right place when you brought it. You were holding back. It wasn't as good as your brother's. And so come back to me, bring the right offering, get your heart in the right place, do what I've asked you to do, and then I'll lift you up. I'll accept your offering. I'll encourage you. I'll be pleased with you. If you'll just do what I've asked you to do, then I'll be like the father who's proud of you. And that's what we see in the first use of this word, that God lifts us up when we follow him, when we listen to him, when we obey him. That's what parents do with their children, right? I mean, when the child does something the father or the mother wants them to do, the father's proud, right? He brags on their children. I mean, some of you know people who are always bragging on their children. They always talk, but that's part of it. It's because their kids make them proud, and so they lift them up, even in front of other people. So the father lifts up his children when they do what he asks them to do. But there's a second meaning of this word nasah that's even more important. It doesn't just mean to lift up, it also means to carry. To carry. Or to bear something. There's all kinds of verses in the Old Testament about camels nasahing spices and supplies on their backs when they're parts of caravans. About soldiers nasahing their shields and their armor into battle. About a man nasahing three goats in his arms. And it's very clear in this sense that nasah means to carry something, to bear a load. In Deuteronomy chapter 1, Moses is speaking to the people of Israel, and they've been fleeing through the wilderness, escaping slavery from Egypt. And God is Moses is kind of giving them a sermon as he's looking back on their time in the wilderness. They're standing at the edge of the promised land. And he thinks about how God has treated them as his children, and he says this. This is verse 31. That was the Hebrew we put up a second ago. In the wilderness, you saw how Yahweh your God nasahed you as a father nasahs his son. See, God, Moses is saying, God carried you in the wilderness. When your feet were giving out, he carried you. When you were tired and weary, he picked you up and he carried you. When you couldn't go on anymore, when you were discouraged, he carried you. And the picture that Moses paints here is almost like you can picture a family going on a hike. In the Colorado mountains, and they decide to take the kids with them, and it's going to be an awesome hike, and like a mile into it, you know, the kids start complaining, and I'm tired, my feet hurt, and I don't want to go on them, and I'm hungry, we don't have any food, and I'm starving, and it's like the kids are complaining about this, all this stuff, and what do mom and dad do? Because they know there's just another mile to go, and if you'll just go with us another mile, you've got it in you. Your feet don't hurt that much. Just keep walking, you know? Because if we get another mile, the view is amazing when we get to this one spot, and we brought a picnic with us, and we're going to have this huge picnic, and we're going to see this amazing. It's going to be awesome. Just hang in there. What do good parents do in that situation when the children have been complaining, and they say they're tired and their feet hurt? Do they say, well, suck it up and keep walking? You're not really tired. You're not hungry. You're not starving. I can show you pictures of kids that are starving. You're not them. Yes, I've done that before. But that's not what God does. The picture is mom and dad saying, all right, buddy, hop on my back. We'll carry you the rest of the way. You're tired. You can't go anymore. We'll carry you. We'll bear your load for you. Now, one thing that's fascinating about the Old Testament is one of the arguments that's made throughout the Old Testament is that Israel's God, Yahweh, is different than all the other gods because he is a father to us. And there's all these arguments that are made throughout all the writings that, yes, there's people that worship all these other gods, but God is not just one of the other gods. It's not just a bunch of different gods and they have different names, but it's all one God and we're all just kind of worshiping one God. No, the Israelites were actually quite exclusive. They were not very inclusive. They were exclusive. And they were always trying to show how the God they worshiped was the one true God. The God they worshiped was different, was unique, and was actually superior to all the other gods. And one time in the book of Isaiah, Isaiah makes this argument clear. And he ties the way that God is different and superior to all the other gods in the way that God is like a father who carries us. Look at what he says. This is Isaiah 46, verse 1. He says, Bel bows down and Nebo stoops low. Bel and Nebo were the name of two Babylonian gods that the Babylonian people worshipped. Their idols are borne by beasts of burden. The images that are Nasad are burdensome, a burden for the weary. He says the word burden all over the place. That's just the noun form of Nasa. They stoop and they bow down together, unable to rescue the burden, and they themselves go off into captivity. Now, let me explain to you real quickly what he's saying here. Isaiah is describing these gods of Babylon who were portrayed in these images and in these statues. And in Babylon, they would actually do these huge processionals and they would carry around these statues and they would put them on donkeys or oxen, or they would even put them on their own shoulders and they would carry them around. And Isaiah is saying, you have to carry your gods around. They're like a burden to you. They've put so many things on your shoulders. They've weighed you down so much. You have to carry them around in a literal sense. And then when the Persian armies came in and wiped out Babylon, do you know what happened? The Babylonian gods didn't save them. They didn't rescue them. In fact, the Persian people carried off the Babylonian idols. And so it's almost as if Isaiah is trying to ask this implicit question, what good is a God that's a burden to you, that you have to carry around, and who won't even help you when times get tough? And I think there's something powerful about this, because we may not worship statues today, but we still worship other gods, right? And we have idols like money, like technology or the latest gadgets, like our weekends. A lot of us worship our weekends, our sports, our sense of adventure, even our families we can make into something we worship, or our careers. Now notice, all of these things are good things, but when they become an object of worship, they actually burden us down, because we carry this sense of responsibility. We always have to keep up with the thing that burdens us down. But Isaiah says, God's not like that. He's different. Look at what Isaiah says, next verse, verse 3, he goes on. Listen to me, you descendants of Jacob, all the remnant of the people of Israel. And this is actually God speaking through Isaiah. You, whom I have upheld since your birth. And that's like father or mother imagery. Basically saying, listen, sons and daughters of me, you who have I have upheld since your birth and have nasad you since you were born. Even to your old age and gray hairs, I am he. I am he who will sustain you, and I have made you, and I will nasa you. I will sustain you, and I will rescue you. And the message that Isaiah is saying is, other gods, you have to carry yourselves. Other gods will load you down with a burden. We worship and follow a God who is a father, who when things get tough, when we're tired and weary, he will carry our burdens for us. And he will even carry us. He's been doing it since the day we were born. He's always carried us. There's just seasons of our life where we're more aware of it or not. But he carries us. God lifts us up. He carries us. But there's one more meaning to this word nasa that I want to tease out this morning. Because you might not know it as you're reading through the Old Testament. But the third meaning is to take or to take away. To take or to take away, because, and this is huge, because in the second sense of the word to carry, the Bible actually says there's a lot of references to people trying to carry their own loads and carry their own burdens. Sometimes those burdens are just difficult circumstances, and it's people trying to walk through difficult circumstances on their own and carry it for themselves because I can get through this, you know, because we're proud and we're stubborn. Sometimes we try to carry our fears. We carry our insecurities. We carry our anxieties and our worries with us everywhere we go. Sometimes we just carry our guilt. We carry our shame. We carry shame over our shortcomings or our weaknesses or our faults. I mean, it's carrying around that sense that I can be a really lazy person sometimes. Or it's carrying around that sense I'm not as good a friend as I sort of portray myself to be. I'm not as good a parent as everybody thinks I am. I haven't done my job very well. I can sometimes think things that are really horrible. I can sometimes do things that are really horrible. And I've kept it a secret. I've kept it from everyone else, but I know. It's like I'm carrying this thing around. And it becomes a burden. It becomes a burden on our conscience. It becomes a burden on our souls and our hearts. In fact, sometimes God even lets us carry those things, as we saw last week. Sometimes he says, you know what? You're so stubborn. I'm going to let you carry this thing until you realize how much of a burden it's becoming. That's God's discipline. But God's discipline is not the last word, because the Old Testament says that God treats even his rebellious children, even the children that are trying to carry things around, God treats us like a father. And there's one description in the Old Testament of God that shows up over and over and over and over. It's the most repeated description of God throughout the whole Old Testament. And the first time it shows up is in Exodus, and this is what it says. This is right when the people of Israel have rebelled against God. Exodus 34, it says this, Yahweh, Yahweh, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love. That word love is the word hesed. It actually means commitment, faithful. He's big. Not like romantic love. Like I just can kind of fall in and out of it. But like the kind of love that a parent has to their children. Committed through thick and thin love. He's abounding in love and faithfulness. He maintaining love to thousands of generations. And nesaing, wickedness, rebellion, and sin. You see, the Bible doesn't just say that God lifts us up when we please him as children, and he doesn't just carry our loads when we're tired. Over and over and over, it says when we actually bring our load to him, whatever that load is, even if that load is rebellion and waywardness and, yes, sin and shame and guilt, when we bring that to him, he will actually take it away. He'll take away. That's what this word nasa in this context means. He will take away our sin. What's the Father like? He's compassionate. He's gracious. He's slow to anger. He's big on commitment. And when we bring it to him, our faults, our failures, our shortcomings, all our junk, he'll actually take it away. You know how this word is actually translated sometimes in our English translations? Forgive. That more often than not, when you see the word forgive in the Old Testament, it's this word nasa. But what you need to know is forgiveness is wrapped up in this idea of God actually taking our sin away. That's what forgiveness means. It's someone who takes the debt from us and says, I'll carry your debt for you. Who takes the load from us and says, I'll be the one who carries it and takes it away for you. And how does God do that? Well, there's one ritual in the Old Testament that gives us a picture into this. Once a year, the people of Israel gathered together for a holiday, and it was called Yom Kippur. It meant the Day of Atonement. And on that day, once a year, everyone confessed their sins and believed that God would take them away. And the way he would take them away is the high priest would come and he would take a live goat, and it later became known as the scapegoat. He would take a live goat, and this is how Leviticus records it in chapter 16. He, that is the high priest, is to lay both hands on the head of the live goat and confess over it all the wickedness and the rebellion of the Israelites, all their sins, and put them on the goat's head. This sounds strange to us, but he shall send the goat away into the wilderness in the care of someone appointed for the task, and the goat will nasa all their sins to a remote place. See, God was using this ancient ritual, this goat, to symbolically show them that he would carry, he would take away their sin if they would bring it to him. And 1,000 years later, Jesus would come, and he would once and for all, through his own sacrifice, say to everyone, God's sons and daughters who bring their sin and their guilt and their rebellion and their shame and whatever it is to him, I will take it away from you. I will carry it for you. I will bear it in my own body. See, this is how much our Father loves us. This is how far the Father goes for us. This is how much he's willing to carry for us what we cannot carry, that he would send his only son for us to carry it for us. We're going to take communion today. We do this once a month here, and we do it regularly to remember Jesus' death for us. The bread symbolizes his body broken for us. The cup of the juice symbolizes his blood spilled for us. And anyone's invited to do this. When the band comes up in a second, they're going to lead us in a song, and you can sing along with them, or you can just listen. But whenever you're ready, you can just go to the back table, and as a way to renew or put your faith in what Jesus has done, you can just break off a piece of bread and dip it in the juice. And as you eat it, you remember Jesus carrying your load for you. But if I could ask you to do one thing today when we take communion together, it would be this. Would you be willing to take whatever burden you're carrying right now and bring it with you to the table? Maybe the burden you're carrying is just you're just tired and you're weary. There's something going on and it's made you tired and weary. That's why Jesus came and he said, everybody who's tired and weary, come to me. My burden is light. My Father's burden is light. We'll take it for you. So bring your burden, whatever it is you're carrying. Take it to the table with you today. Maybe it is, to be blunt, sin. Maybe there's some sort of pride you're harboring in your heart. Maybe there's bitterness. There's anger. Maybe there's somebody that you're really holding a grudge against, and it's just you've just been carrying it around. Maybe there's a secret habit, something so embarrassing that nobody else knows about, but it's like it's just eating away at your soul because you're carrying it. If I could leave you with any words, these are the last ones we'll read from the Bible. It would be these from David. Look at what he says in Psalm 32. Blessed is the one whose transgressions are nasad, are carried, are taken away, whose sins are covered. Because when I kept silent, my bones wasted away. My strength was sapped as in the heat of summer because he's carrying this burden. But then I acknowledged my sin to you, God, and I didn't cover up my iniquity anymore. I said, I will confess my transgressions to Yahweh, and you, nasad, the guilt of my sin. Don't keep carrying it around today. Take it to the table with you. Give it to Jesus. And let the Father's love welcome you back home. Carry away your burden. And once again remind you, you are his son. You're his daughter. And he loves you. Let me pray. And then we'll take communion together. Father God, in the midst of reading a bunch of verses and passages and looking at a number of stories and words and Hebrew and all those kind of things. God, I pray that you would just communicate through those things your love for us. And God, whatever we're carrying, whether it's the weight of a big decision, whether it's pressure that's been put on us from somebody else, whether it's the fear of an unknown future, or even if it's just something in our hearts that we know still stands between us and you. Even if we've been following you for a long time, Christians for decades, God, I pray that we just bring it to the table today and know that there we'll find grace. Because that's who you are. You're compassionate. You're gracious. You're slow to anger. You're big. You're big on commitment. You're big on faithfulness and love. And when we bring our load to you, you carry it and take it away. Pray this in Jesus' name.